The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Good morning, everyone. So welcome to the Sunday morning practice group. So my name is Wynne Fricke. I'm one of the co-founders of Common Ground, which got started back in 1993. So it's had a long and graceful growth over these decades. And I practiced a bit in the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition with Upandita as our grandfather, and also in the Thai forest tradition. So I'll just offer what I can today. Mark Nunberg is the guiding teacher here. Normally he teaches this, but he's on the East Coast at the Insight Meditation Society. He's teaching for these this next 10 days. So, in the Buddhist Studies program on Monday night, we've been studying what's called the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the Buddha's basic instructions on the meditation on the breath. And it's actually a 16-part sutta, 16 instructions in terms of guiding the meditator in ways of looking at the breath. And I was feeling a little muddled with the information. I thought, I'll take that opportunity to just kind of dig into a little bit of it, to maybe share with you. Because if you've been coming to Common Ground for a while or other Buddhist meditation centers, chances are you've been studying some aspect or other of the Anapanasati Sutta. So it just might be nice to introduce it, at least the first part of it, a little bit methodically, because it is kind of central teaching which can contain the whole of the Buddhist path from the first step to the 16th step. And it's seen as like a pyramid with the beginning instructions are more toward cultivating samadhi or cultivating balance, cultivating a kind of power of mind which, through the later steps, allows a more penetrating insight and allows kind of a vertical ascension with that. So that's how those 16 steps are viewed. And I was just thinking about the word respiration, kind of, you know, why the breath? You know, like, why do we do the breath and respiration? And it has just an interesting, you know, root, like spirit is part of the respiration, right? Spirit. Like the animating force, the animating principle. It's also in some ways described as the breathing of animals and also the wind. So it has these beautiful meanings. And respire, respiration, respires again. So again, spirit. And so it's lovely. In actuality, I mean, the Buddha considered the breath a kind of perfect object because for most of us, it's a neutral object. It has vitality. It's alive in the body, right? It's alive in the body, but it doesn't sort of, you know, we're not afraid of the breath. It doesn't inspire anger. It doesn't inspire fear necessarily. So it's a neutral object for the mind to gather around, right? So really, we use the breath in the service of what we're cultivating in the mind. It's not like the breath is magical, right? So it's about studying the mind through the breath. How am I doing in terms of sound? Yeah? Okay, good. So I'm just going to read the very first small paragraph of the sutta. The Buddha asks, now how is it mindfulness of in and out breathing developed and pursued so as to be of great fruit, of great benefit? And then he goes on, there is the case where a practitioner, having gone to the wilderness or to the shade of a tree or to an empty building, sits down, folding their legs crosswise, holding their body erect, and setting mindfulness to the fore, always mindful. He or she breathes in, always mindful, he or she breathes out. So this very first part, which is like a prologue you know, he's talking about the importance of seclusion, right? That we create a container that has safety, that has protection from the agitation of this wild world, right? We need to be intentional around that. And so, you know, there's this whole beautiful history of monasteries in Asia which are designed for this purpose. You know, they're very simple, and there are many rules to kind of keep things very simple so that all the attention can be sort of turned inward toward our own mind, toward our own body, toward our own heart. So as lay people, I think it needs to be an active question, like how can we create these containers where we cannot be pushed around by what's going to push us around, that we can be devoted for at least this 5 minutes to our training, to our aspiration. And if we don't know our aspiration, get clear about that too. What is our aspiration in this life? So finding these powerful containers, both physically and mentally. And I'm just going to read this little overview written by Ajahn Sumedho from the Thai forest tradition, who's been an important teacher for me and for others in this community. But this is his commentary. It's very long, but I'm just going to read a little bit on the Anapanasati Sutta. And he says, the sort of knowledge we gain from Buddhist meditation is humbling. Ajahn Chah calls it earthworm knowledge. It doesn't make you arrogant. It doesn't puff you up. It doesn't make you feel that you are anything or that you have attained anything. In worldly terms, this practice doesn't seem very important or necessary. Nobody is ever going to write a newspaper headline, "At 8 o'clock this evening, Venerable Sumedho had an inhalation." To some people, thinking about how to solve the world's problems might seem very important, how to help all the people in the third world, how to set the world right. Compared with these things, watching our breath seems insignificant. And most people think, why waste time doing that? People have confronted me about this, saying, what are you monks doing sitting there? What are you doing to help humanity? You're selfish. You expect people to give you food while you just sit there and watch your breath. You're running away from the real world. But what is the real world? Who is really running away and from what? What is there to face? We find that what people call the real world is the world they believe in, the world that they are committed to, or the world that they know and are familiar with. But that world is a condition of mind. Meditation is actually confronting the real world, recognizing and acknowledging it as it really is, rather than believing in it or justifying it or trying to mentally annihilate it. Now, the real world operates on the same pattern of arising and passing as the breath. We're not theorizing about the nature of things, taking philosophical ideas from others and trying to rationalize with them. But by watching our breath, we're actually observing the way nature is. When we're watching the breath, we're actually observing nature. Through understanding the nature of the breath, we can understand the nature of conditioned phenomena. If we try to understand all conditioned phenomena in their infinite variety, quality, different time span, and so on, it would be too complex. Our minds wouldn't be able to handle it. We have to learn from simplicity. So with a tranquil mind, we become aware of the cyclical pattern. We see that all that arises passes away. That cycle is called samsara, the wheel of birth and death. We observe the samsaric cycle of the breath. We inhale, and then we exhale. We can't have only inhalations or only exhalations. The one conditions the other. It would be absurd to think, I only want to inhale. I don't want to exhale. I'm giving up exhalation. My life will be just one constant inhalation. That would be ridiculous. If I said that to you, you'd think I was crazy. But that's what most people do. How foolish people are when they want only to attach to excitement, pleasure, youth, beauty, and vigor. I only want beautiful things, and I'm not going to have anything to do with the ugly. I want pleasure and delight and creativity, but I don't want any boredom or depression. It's the same kind of madness as if you were to hear me saying, I can't stand inhalations. I'm not going to have them anymore. When we observe that attachment to beauty, when we observe that attachment to beauty, sensual pleasure will always lead to despair, then our attitude is one of non-attachment. That doesn't mean annihilation or any desire to destroy, but simply letting go, non-attachment. We don't seek perfection in any part of the cycle, but we see that perfection lies in the whole cycle. It includes old age, sickness, and death. What arises in the uncreated reaches its peak and then returns to the uncreated, and that is perfection. As we start to see that, all sankharas, that's like formations of the mind, have this pattern of arising and passing away, we begin to go inwards toward the unconditioned, the peace of mind, its silence. So, you know, you're probably like me in that, you know, kind of facing the day. There's a lot of resistance sometimes to settling in and kind of actually believing in, you know, that there's good reason to quiet the mind and to sit and to ground, right? I'm going to go to school and I'm teaching and I'm not ready, and, you know, just the pouring of anxiety that, you know, maybe all of us wake up with. I don't know. I wake up with it. So it's like being creative. Like, I find for myself, I can go on retreat and the mind is secluded and very powerful. But during my workday, going to McAllister, the mind is really dispersed and there's a lot of anxiety. And so it's like, instead of sitting in the morning where I feel still pushed around, I will walk to work because I feel like I can connect with my footsteps, right? I can just feel. And there's just something in the activity of moving that some of that anxious energy can dissipate. So we can study ourselves, like what works for us, how we ourselves can kind of find our centeredness, our ridge pole, where the mind will be willing to settle, kind of not willing to cave in to our irritations and anxieties. There's something in that, like we cave. We're so frightened, you know, that there's that thing that happens. And so it's like we have to be smart in how we work with these forces in the mind, you know. And as wisdom grows, we get better at that, you know, because wisdom tells us sit, you know. We don't have to argue anymore. And that grows in the mind. But we're all on this path, right? And so we have to be really asking those questions, really investigating, you know, the places where we feel pressures and how to work with them. This reminded me of, maybe some of you saw the Sherlock Holmes, this most recent British series. There was one that was called His Last Vow with Augustus Magnuson. He's this media mogul. But anyway, he's sort of the arch enemy in this one. And his power is like being able to detect in people their particular pressure points, what he calls their pressure point, the thing which is going to make them cave, that they're so afraid of, the thing that's going to knock them off their center, and then he can have power over them. And I think, oh, that's how it is. Like, when I sit down, oh, that was a pressure point. I just kind of went out. Like, that was a place for me. So that's like a useful metaphor, just to kind of feel and recognize the pressures that are operating, kind of acknowledging them. And in terms of, like, the training and the trajectory of the practice, Joseph Goldstein has this wonderful metaphor where he talks about, like, if you have a bowl, you put the bowl upside down and put a pearl on the top. It's like, you know, someone, giving you the finger on a road is going to, that will push it, and then the pearl will easily fall off, right? Or getting a diagnosis that we don't want to hear pushes it, and the pearl rolls off. But with practice, it's like that bowl becomes inverted, and you put the pearl in the base. Something pushes it. It will roll, but it comes back right away, right? So that's the nature of the training, that we move from being like a leaf in the wind to having that ridge pole. We get knocked off, but we know where our center is. We know that North Star. So the first four instructions in the mindfulness of breathing instructions, they're all about bringing attention to the breath and the body, to grounding the attention in the breath and the body, and stabilizing the mind. So I like the term gathering the mind. It's so visceral, because we can just feel when we're dispersed energetically, but it's a sense of gathering and stabilizing the mind. And the body is a natural place, right? The thoughts are quick, and they're slippery, and they seduce us. So we could... Thoughts are an object of mind, but we need to have a basic stability before we can venture into actually attending to the thoughts in a way that will be useful. So that's why we begin with the body. And all of these 16 steps are breathing in, I experience. Breathing out, I experience. So the breath is part the whole way. The breath is included the whole way in each of the 16 steps. So the first one, and I just want to say too, mindfulness, I think mindfulness even is like a mystery. Like, what are we talking about when we say mindfulness? And I think it's like developing a taste and a sense of what mindfulness is also. But one thing that's helpful for me is really this metaphor of space or of a field that is, it's not shakable. It can hold the difficulty. It can hold the activity of the mind. So the mind can be bored. The mind can be agitated. The mind can be enraged. But there's a space that holds it, that can be aware of it. So being aware of the rage is not the same as being in the rage. So it's like this really subtle thing. And Ajahn Sumedho has this image of like the space in the room. The space is the space. And if I were to fling a brush of heavy paint, into the room, it would land, but it would not disturb the space, right? The space is untouched by that flinging of the paint. So we can think of the part of the mind as an investigation that is untouched by whatever is moving through. So bringing mindfulness to the fore, the first prologue context in our space of seclusion. And then the first instruction is just what we did as we were sitting. Breathing in long, one knows I am breathing in long. Breathing in short, one knows I am breathing in short. Those are actually the first two instructions. So one whole instruction from each. So the guidance here is to know the character of each breath, of each inhalation, of each exhalation, of the space at the top of the inhalation, the space at the bottom of the exhalation, like to get really close. So what happens with mindfulness of the breath, I think, with all of us, is that we can fall into a rhythm, into an easy pattern, that we just kind of get a little bit in a trance, a little bit softly hypnotized. And it's neither interesting or it's just kind of there. So when he's saying when the breath is long, we know the breath is long, so it's each breath. So because we, just in a really unconscious way, we assume, oh, I've seen it, done, the mind's not interested, right? It's like, and this is very natural. So it's a kind of penetrating focus that looks more deeply and looks more clearly. There's a sustaining quality. And the mind can become like a microscope with that training, with that sustaining kind of attention. And also, what what kind of gives this momentum is we begin to feel the refuge of the mind moving with the breath, because we're secluded from what normally agitates us. And when we feel that, that is that can be motivating, because we really get how wholesome it is. And it's a real refuge, it's a real respite, that we're nourished and then we can go back to our lives and be clearer and more nourished for that. And I just want to say briefly too, just as a pointing out, there's a teaching that was so useful to me that is about what the Buddha talked about in his way, the four elements of materiality. And this is a conceptual framework, but it's like earth, air, water, earth, wind, water, and fire. Thank you. So they're just conceptual categories, but under each of the categories, he lined up like all these ways of observing materiality. Like fire, for instance, you know, is temperature. So with just the breath, you can notice there's gradations of temperature. The temperature of the in-breath is different than the temperature of the out-breath. The temperature of one nostril will be different than the, you know, so that's just fire, right? There's a whole category under fire. You know, under water, there's this sense of cohesiveness, of flow, of heavy wetness, like the organs. That's all under the category of water. Under the category of earth is like hardness, like when you feel the teeth touching, or softness, the sense of the tips of the fingers or the lips. So these are really wonderful things to study, because then when you're watching the breath, it's like, oh, you know, you can look at the temperature, you can look at the pressure, you can look at the liquidity, you can look at the flow, and it becomes very detailed and very interesting. So just if you have a moment, those are really, it's just wonderful to kind of track all these descriptive words about what goes on in sort of this wilderness of the body and the wilderness of the breath. And then the next step is one trains oneself breathing in, I will experience the whole body. One trains oneself breathing out, I will experience the whole body. So we move from the body of the breath to the whole body. And there's a knowing. The breath happens in a context. It happens in the context of our physical body. And different traditions treat this instruction differently. Like if you've studied with S.N. Goenka, he does this body scan. So like breathing in, breathing out, you know, you're aware of the breath, but all the while you're doing this body scan, a scan that's like the size of a thumbnail, that you trace with intricate detail all down the body. So it's really methodical, a methodical way to get to know the body. Other ways are just more organic. You know, some traditions, like I breathe feeling the arm, I breathe feeling the arm, or, you know, just organically moving from part to part. And sometimes it's just nice to sort of feel the field of the energy of the body. You know, it's just like the body and the breath are held in the same field of just a vibration of aliveness, vitality, presence. So the point is not to get tight about it, about which instruction, which way to go, but just know there's a body here. How do we feel the body as we're breathing in and as we're breathing out? So that's the third instruction. So first instruction, breathing in long, one knows I am breathing in long. Breathing out long, one knows I am breathing out long. Second instruction, breathing in short, one knows I am breathing in short. Breathing out short, one knows I'm breathing out short. Third, one trains oneself breathing in, I will experience the whole body. One trains oneself breathing out, I will experience the whole body. And then the fourth instruction is, one trains oneself breathing in, I calm the body, or I calm the bodily formations. One trains oneself breathing out, I calm the bodily formations. So it's really important and significant that step three happens before step four. So step three is about intimacy. We know the body. We're not trying to calm. We're not trying to do anything. We're just knowing just as it is. So there's a profoundly accepting, interested intimacy in the experience of the body. And then once we're there, we can invite the body to be calm. So breathing in, I calm the bodily formations. Breathing out, I calm the bodily formations. So sometimes, if you just go directly to kind of, I don't like this tension, calm, I want to calm, the body and the mind won't cooperate with that. And I think that's true with a lot of things. We need to be intimate with our anger. We can't just say shut up, right? We need intimacy. We need to understand. We're there first before we can have any kind of effective intervention or I learned this really well. I come from dance. I'm a professional dancer and choreographer, and it was so interesting, like in the study of tension and release and intimacy of the body. And I do modern dance, so we do a lot of like falling through space, right? And there was one day where I was doing these sort of lunge falls where you do a lunge, and then the whole weight of the torso and the head go over, and then you swing up, and you land on vertical, and then you do it to the side, whole weight of the body, you swing up. And it's like you're falling through space, and the weight of the head is part of it. And then one day, I just noticed I was holding the breath, that there was just some contraction in the breath that was really inhibiting this particular movement. And it was like, and I had done this movement 100,000 times, and then one time, intimate with the movement, one time I saw there's holding, the subtle holding in the breath. And then I could invite it to let go. And then it's like, and it changed. It was so interesting. Just that release, that simple release of tension invited more intimacy. It's like when we relax, we feel more, don't we? It's like, I think that's why we tighten. It's hard to feel sometimes, and it's like a fake way of not feeling. We tighten, but just that invitation to relax, the body could organize. It could exert its own intelligence with that relaxation. It was a really interesting and specific example for me of this principle. Wow. Well, I only got through four. I had eight, and it's 11:32. So maybe we could stop and just see if there's questions or things that have come up, and then we've got a microphone, so let's...
Is it on? Okay. I just wanted to say Nancy Bowler has a deep relaxation class tonight at 4, well, this afternoon, and just going through all that you're mentioning... If you really want to tap into that today, it's at 4, and she really walks you through that whole breathing and scanning your body. When you did this, it's like, yeah, that's what Nancy does. She has you scan your body, and in this space, there's just a lot of relaxing and calming that happens. So, anyway.
Thank you.
So you mentioned calming the body or the bodily formations or formation. Could you explain more about bodily formation?
I think that the formations give it a little bit of an active quality, like the body feels more like a noun. Formations feel like, they point to the verb of the body. That's my interpretation, but I'm not sure. So it's been translated in both ways, so it's really a translation.
Just picking up on that, for me, what the difference was there was that it depersonalized it. When I think about the body, it's like, oh, this is this body that I've had all this trouble with all these years. And when it's the bodily formation, it's just like, it's just nature. The formation being known.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Jeff. That was well said. And you know, these first four instructions are geared towards samadhi, but insight also happens in these first four instructions. You know, like when we're in the body in that really deep way, it's like, where is the self? Really, like you can kind of ask that question and investigate the answer, like in detail, like where is the self? Yeah, thank you.
One thing I really like about this particular sutta is because, I mean, I'm actually just responding to what you just said, because when you, some kind of way, the ordering of the words, it brings me a deep level of calm. And there's a way in which whatever I might kind of imagine to be a self is kind of unstuck to the body. So we might think of it as relaxation, but there's a way in which I become aware that, like, I'm not, like, whatever the spirit is doesn't have to cling so tightly to this body. So that's one. I don't know why those instructions are just so powerful, but I don't know, but it's just my experience. And so I thought you did a great job in walking us through it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, we ungrasp naturally. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that I have, I guess, is whenever I notice the breath, I really want to control it. Do you have any recommendations for noticing it without controlling or judging it?
I think that's really natural, and I think it's okay. Just to kind of know that's happening, I think it's not unusual at all. Sometimes, like, the word listening is helpful for me. Just like how effortless listening is. It's just sort of sound meets the ear. It's just like no exertion. So I have that attitude, like listening to the breath or listening to the sensations of the body really helps place me in that receptive, more receptive place. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, this is really, really helpful. I wondered if that text that you have from Ajahn Sumedho, is that available anywhere for us to read the full thing? Because that was really, I really appreciated the way that he broke that down, and I felt like in a very accessible way to, at least in Western framework, like,
yeah.
It just was really helpful. So I would love to be able to read the whole thing.
Yeah. It's if you just Google Ajahn Sumedho Anapanasati. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And it's online, I think, on the Common Ground, website.
Oh, mm-hmm. 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 First, thank you very much for the teaching, Wen. It was lovely. I really appreciate you giving attention to the importance of step three coming before step four, like intimacy coming before relaxation. Oftentimes I notice that when relaxation comes before intimacy, or relaxation is the only point of my practice in that moment. Nothing wrong with that. It's good. Sometimes I just need that, you know, because life is crazy. But when I do have a little more stability on a day or in a practice session, I find that being really clear to get intimate first and then move to relaxation allows for greater investigation as to, like, what's causing the chaos in the body and in the mind. And what I find is when I don't do it in that way and I'm just relaxing, again, great respite, very important, but I don't get insight into, like, what's going on, like, what's the script that's running this story. And so the benefits to my life sometimes can be rather short-lived to that session or a few hours after that. But when I do investigate much deeper, then the benefits to my life often come with greater insight, like, oh, this pattern is playing out, and this is why I keep creating this situation. And from there, like, that insight allows me to make a certain change in the way I'm thinking or moving through life. And yeah, I just find that is, the benefits can be, not always, but can be more longer lasting. And so anchoring that in my experience of the body, yeah, I just really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Femi. That was really well said. And I'm you know, it can be an instruction when we're paying attention to the mental life, which of course is, you know, our afflictions are rolled up in that. Like, you know, you were talking about anger, and for me, just doing a lot of work around fear. And the part that I don't think needs to be investigated is, like, why am I so afraid? Like, there's something about that we can go down the rabbit hole. Like, why was I born so afraid in this world? You know, whatever. And it's like, so, but to know, like, fear as it is, you know what I mean? And as it is partly the story in the mind. So it's like, yeah, so, and for me, it is like a radical accepting. So it's like knowing and accepting. So it's not just knowing, it's like, this is here. And I wasn't really able to, you know, I hated my fear so much, you know, and it was like trying everything. But it wasn't until there was a movement of interest and acceptance that I felt the ground shift. Like, real interest. What is this terror in the body? What's the story in the mind? What is this unpleasantness? And really just like this wide open, compassionate movement to allow it to be there. Like, let me see what the heck is going on, you know? And then, there, you know, a lot of time living in that space, again and again and again, opening, opening, opening. And again, it's a movement of the heart that I don't think it can be done out of hatred, you know? It's like, that will just get you so far, but there's a movement of compassion around what afflicts us, around what makes us suffer, where we can really begin to soften. Thank you, Femi, yeah.
I got the mic.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Becca. I really loved the movement, how you're bringing it this morning. The movement with that really resonates with how I live in my body and how I am in the world. Really moving the teachings out from this ideas and, you know, how it can tend to just be here. Like, there's all this movement, which I was loving. And my question or a sticking point is, and when you talked about the bowl, I feel like I flipped the bowl over, but there's like 27 pearls in there, and it's like this gangbuster show of like trying to get. So my weekly experience is that I have these moments during my very chaotic day where I'm just like that ridge pole, like there's this hint, and it's this thirst to like spend more time there, but then it's gone, like. So I was really appreciating what you were saying, and just kind of my question is, maybe you could give me some insight here about how can I use my body differently? Like I find, you know, I'm in a professional space, so, you know, it's, I feel there's some limitations, but I'm curious, like from your own practice with that chaos, how could I use my body, or what's a way, or some things that you might've been trying that kind of bring that ridge pole back, or just a touch point a little bit more frequently during the day that's happening here as opposed to just in my mind? Because I can stop and I can breathe. I can sense my feet. And then I'm back at it,
yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
just something different. Yeah.
Well, sometimes, like for me, like fear, for instance, manifests here a lot. Like right here in the diaphragm, right in the solar plexus. So it's like instead of like using the body as just like you can be investigating what's knocking you off. Like, is it irritation? Is it what are the things? Because if it's irritation or anxiety, like that will have a specific location. So with fear, for me, it's like, boom. I just train, you know, because it's so alive and it just anchors me. And it's like, as Jeff was saying, it's this movement of nature. And so I can just come into my body as an expression of fear. So it's not like I'm avoiding the fear and coming to my feet, you know? So there's something about tying the actual suffering, you know, into the body and how the body is suffering too, like that contraction in the body. So I think, you know, I think like a friend was saying, you know, she was just noticing, like, she just notices the corners of her mouth, like, just gather tension when she's in particular thing. So that has become her anchor, like the corners of her mouth kind of let her know, you know, whatever. So that maybe there's something that is calling to you, like a place that wants to be known in relationship to the kind of suffering that you're feeling, the kind of things that knock you off. Yeah. Okay, it's 11:45. Let's just take a moment in silence. Thanks for coming out, everyone.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.